What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Being realistic.
As the story grows.
Welcome back to the next chapter of As the Story Grows. My name is Trav, and on the other side of the mic, we got Steven over there. Steven, say hello to all the people who were nice enough to listen.
Hello.
Now say hello to all the people who were mean and didn't listen. Steven is sick. He's been blowing his nose in my ear for 15 minutes, and it sucks, and it sounds so gross.
Only,
I feel like it's running down my neck.
You deserve it.
Whatever.
Yeah, I'm a little under the weather of allergy season. Hit me like a freaking Mack truck. I'm gonna try my best not to sneeze and snot all over the all over the conversation.
Beautiful.
But I'll do my best. So who are we talking to today?
Well, we mustered up a hard to find fellow. We've been trying to get this guy on the show for a while now.
One of the hardest people to talk to get. Like a hold of and to talk to.
I know. It was weird. Wow. Justin Carroll, former bassist of the band Narcissus.
Yep.
And he married my cousin. And
my sister.
He's Steven's brother-in-law. And his last name is my mom's first name.
Which is weird.
That is weird for me. Yeah.
And
there's more?
There's more. To about five people out there, he's known as the co-host of the original Tourist Trap podcast.
That's right. Justin and Steven had a podcast. five, six years ago or so.
Yeah, we got about 37, 8, I can't remember, episodes in, and
wow, that was it. I can't even remember that. We had 38 or 37?
30, yeah. Well, the last two was with Scott.
But
you were about 35 of them, and then we did the Great Exchange for some other for five other people.
Yeah, I think it was a lot, three other people.
So we've podcasted together before, and
yeah,
it's been a while since we've done that. But this is a different show, and we're gonna talk about some of the past.
Justin was out in that super cool happening Ohio scene. Mm-hmm. And he moved out here for our family. So you were just a foolish, full of bad decisions.
Yeah, this is true, actually. Yeah, you know, something about that Ohio scene. I always wondered, back when I was in it, if there were other scenes. I mean, I'm sure there were. Like, there was the Birmingham, Alabama scene, there's a little bit of the California scene.
Mm-hmm.
But I always wondered, and then in Pennsylvania, you guys had your own little, like, Lancaster scene with Purple Door and, mm-hmm. and a couple other bands. So, I don't know, I kind of felt like I lived in a little bit of a bubble back then, like the Canton, Akron area where we came from.
You had Alternafest, which was cooler than Purple Door.
Yeah, we did. We had Alternafest.
You should have moved to Miami for 4 years and won 2 championships and then come back to Ohio. Is that too much sports, Stephen?
That's way too much sports.
That was one sentence in 18 episodes. Seriously? That's too much? Okay.
That's great.
Justin likes sports now.
Sort of. Like, I watch hockey, and I'm definitely into UFC or MMA. Well, I should say UFC. MMA is bigger than the UFC, but I just watch the UFC.
I can't handle that stuff.
I went out with Brad,
Brad Jacob, the guy who recorded the Unteachers album. He and I went out one night. We were driving around trying to figure out something to do. We happened upon this bar, and we happened to walk in like a major UFC night or MMA night or whatever.
Like hundreds of like Mohawks and tap out shirts.
You got it. Yeah, and we walked in, and we were the two least tough people in there, and we were like, oh my God, what's going on?
Oh, wow. Yeah, there is like, that's the face of like, you have, not the face, I guess, but it's a thing. You don't have to do it, but it's definitely a thing.
There was a big, kind of an overweight dude. When he won, he climbed up on the octagon and started slapping his own belly and being like, yeah, that guy was hilarious, whatever
he was.
Did he have a mullet? Was that Big Country?
That was him.
Yeah, that was him. Yeah, yeah.
And then the winner of the main match or whatever, they brought a stool over for him to sit down, and then they like zoomed in really tight on his face, and they were like, the reason that we're zooming in tight on his face is because we don't want you to see this. And then they took the camera and showed everybody anyway. They panned down to his foot, and his pinky toe was just pointing off to the side.
It was John Jones. Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, to speaking of tapping out, I was like, I'm not a blood freak out guy and everything, but I saw that, and I was just like, oh, my God, Brad.
Yeah, man, I remember that. When he won the fight, he was like, oh, man, I was planning on going to Disney World. Like, I guess he had, like, some trip planned, but he had a delay because now he has this, like...
Now my foot's broken in half, and I have to get that fixed. Yeah.
Yeah,
that was... And I decided that night, that was my induction and exit. I cannot watch that stuff.
Well, you'll be pleased to hear that I'm super excited for the next football season.
Oh,
it's,
yeah?
It's a tad far off, but I'm definitely going to watch, like, a full season of the Eagles for the first time ever in my life.
I don't understand why you've picked the worst season to start paying attention to the Eagles.
I would not know at all, actually. Like,
okay, well then, hey, they're going to be great.
I know. It's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying. I'm trying the sports thing. Hockey has stuck, so.
That's cool. Hockey is fantastic. That's great. Well, that's enough sports, because I can hear people turning off turning off their iPad. Yeah, even Steven. Yeah. But we wanted to talk.
No, I was actually thinking about not to interrupt you, but I was.
But you did anyway, so go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking. You know, when you go to those UFC fights and you're uncomfortable and you're not sure if you belong, just look for the Calvinist section.
Like the Young Restless Reformed section.
Yeah.
That's great. They actually have a section.
No, yeah, it's kind of a stereotype in like Reformed circles. It's deep,
like,
man. That's some deep.
Calvinist guys like to drink at pubs. They like to drink beer. They like to grow beards. They like to go to UFC fights. Like, it's just like that kind of thing. Like,
really?
The stereotype. I don't subscribe to it. I'm making fun of people who think that.
Was that in the original 95 thesis? I don't follow that closely.
I think we're up to 195 now.
we had to amend an entire UFC beer drinking.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, anyway.
So.
Yeah, this isn't a tourist trap episode. I want to actually keep listenership up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the band days.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Let's talk about the band days. So.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm in a band called Tantrum the Muse. We get signed to a label called Take Hold Records. And the summer of 2000 rolls around.
Boring.
Hold on, I'm getting to it. And we record an album, and we find out that our label was going to be sending the new signed band from Ohio, Narcissist, all the way to Newark, Delaware, right smack after we recorded Modern Music. They were going to send this band from Ohio all the way up to where we were and come in and record their new album, followed by a big summer tour that we were all the new heavy bands of that label were going to go on. And we knew who Narcissist was, but we never really got to talk to them. We never played with them or anything. And
how did that even happen? Like, how did you even hear about us?
I don't remember how it all started.
It's just like the circle thing. Like, if you're in the circle, you kind of know about other bands.
The way we heard about you guys is because we were doing a lot of like interviews in like these punk zines.
Yeah.
And we would see your name around, and we saw the EP ads and stuff like that. But we never like hung out or anything. Like we used to be friends with the Vessel guys, which are from Ohio.
Yeah, the Youngstown boys. Yeah, we were really good friends with them. So that was like common ground for us.
There's our tie-in because Mike from Vessel signed Crutch to his label.
Yeah, yeah, it's weird. It's like this weird,
yeah, that's right,
weird circle of people who hung out and played music together. But Narcissist and Tantrum were like, hadn't like hooked up yet until we all became label mates in the summer of 2000.
Yeah. I think I said this before. Now I get to interrupt you.
Okay.
There's something weird about this scene that you're talking about, Justin, out here in Lancaster. We were like the brother scene to Ohio somehow.
Yeah, that's true. It was proximity. I mean, yeah, you're like, skipped 6 hours down the road.
We skipped Pittsburgh. You know what I mean? For some reason.
That's true, actually. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Yeah, the West Virginia Zayo scene and everything. I don't know how they did with the Ohio thing and everything, but for some reason I felt like when I was in Crutch, I was hanging with more dudes from Ohio than I was from people who lived in my backyard. It was really weird.
Yeah, Zayo was like up our way a lot, so it was like a bit of a circle, like on the East Coast from Ohio to like Jersey, like this circle.
And I think the reason why we didn't really hit the Pittsburgh scene as much is because Zayo left the Pittsburgh scene so fast, and I don't think there was much of a scene. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it just seemed like Zayo got too big too fast. They were off touring all the time, so we were on that lesser known plane of local bands, and so we just happened to get booked by Vessel, and then through that it was like we were going to Ohio, they were coming here, and we just all hung out, and then Narcissist was like this band we kept hearing about, but we never got to see them. But that summer in 2000, we had just recorded our new Tantrum of the Muse album, and it was going to be coming out like 2 months later for the summer tour in July. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we were probably out of the studio for 48 hours when Narcissist came following right behind us.
I was just going to say, I think we were back to back with you guys, and that's how we first met, because we were in Delaware with, what was his name, Nick.
Nick Rotundo.
Nick Rotundo.
Clay Creek. Right.
Yep. That's right. We were with him, and then you guys came down because just to say hello, I think, or just to hang out or something like that, because you knew that we were going to be on tour together, and we were kind of like, I don't know, not breaking the ice, but we were ready. We were all ready to get started. So we were like, let's just...
There was this local festival called Screaming at the Sky.
Mm-hmm.
And we were booked to play that right after. I mean, like, I think it was like the following day from when we left the studio. And we had a rough, unmastered mix of the album. And I remember we took it and we were playing it. And it was like a big, exciting time. It was all these cool bands playing. I think Zayo played that, actually, that year. And Narcissist is like just showing up to Delaware to get their album recorded. And Jim was hanging out there helping out recording.
It makes sense. Jim would do that.
Oh my God. Yeah. I think I still have the Screaming at the Sky 2000.
Yeah.
Like it was beyond a
flyer.
It wasn't a flyer. It was like a book. It was like they folded it in half.
Yeah, I have that too. Yeah.
I have that around here somewhere.
Because I remember thinking like, oh man, we got to get Narcissist on the bill because they're in town, but they were like so busy just getting in the studio.
Right.
But, so yeah, we played that, and then we came back to the studio because Jim was helping. Jim was just hanging out at the studio, just kind of helping out. And
hang it out. It's what I do.
Yeah. And there was this little restaurant, this little, like, sandwich shop, like, next to this, kind of, like, near the studio.
Oh, yeah, it's like a little college town right there.
My first time seeing Justin was like, we pull up, and he's coming out of that restaurant with the guys in the band, and they're walking across, coming toward the studio, and all I remember was hearing Justin like, "This freaking sucks!" Like, out loud, but like, freaking was another F word.
Yeah,
and I remember being like, "Oh man, that guy's like super pissed." And we just hit it off. We all hung out and got acquainted before our big summer tour that was coming up, and so that's how we met. But Justin, your story goes back further than that. Tell us some narcissist, how that all came together. Tell us how you got into the music and all that.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know, like, how far back do you want me to go? You know, I was always in bands, I guess, like, since I was like.
Dude, I found it. I found it.
Oh, for the love.
Oh, the scream from the sky.
Aragorn, Boy Wonder, Uziel, Seth W., Vessel, Crutch.
Uh-oh.
Tantrum and the Muse. Of course, they got to play after us. I hated them. Counter Directive, Solace, Redeem. Remember them and all their white t-shirts?
Yeah, they were from Ohio, right? Cleveland.
Redeem?
No, they were from New Jersey.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
They were like, if you can't get Zoo, just get Redeem.
Yeah, well, they got Redeem, and then Quest, and then Spine Belt, and then 11 o'clock was Zayo.
11 o'clock. Yeah.
Excuse there you me. Go. Sorry. Move on.
Yeah.
Move on.
Yeah.
Hey, man. Yeah, so how it started with me is I've been in bands since I was like 13 or 14, and then I've always played like something different, but I kind of landed on bass, and then I got into kind of the hardcore scene. There was a guy, a guy who I became friends with and kind of introduced me to like a lot of hardcore music back in Ohio, and then got in this one band. I forget the name of the band. And then I met John LaRussa through that band, because we were in a band before Narcissist, John and I. I forget the name of it. But that's how John and I met, and then that rolled into Narcissist. And that's how I met everybody that I know. And then that kind of like opened the floodgates for...
Yeah.
I mean, that leads all the way into like marrying your sister, and like it just like opened up my entire life.
So Narcissist was kind of like your first real gig, and it just happened to be the one that took you down into the...
Yeah, like, we definitely took the band before that seriously, but I don't think that we were aware of the Tooth and Nail scene, and we really liked it, but I don't think I think we were a little too young, and then when we got into Narcissist, it was like, I think we can do this. I think we actually have a shot at making something like this happen. And all the guys in Narcissist were really, like, John Pope was super good at just, like, making contacts and reaching out.
Yeah.
And John LaRussa was not bad at it at all himself. And then I would try to pitch in with, like, marketing or, like, the logos and the t-shirts and blah, blah, blah. And so it was kind of a good, like, team to make that push. And we got on Takehold. So that was, like, a huge win for us.
Well, before Takehold... the EP, and forthwith came out Blood and Water. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did. It's
sweet.
It's,
were you on that EP?
Band. Yeah, that was the first. I was there since the beginning. Like, there was never an album that
That's
wasn't
what
on at the beginning. Yeah, and that came out on Clenched Fist Records, which was a record label. Wait, did it come out on Clenched Fist?
Yeah. It sounds really familiar.
Yeah, that was the guy who ran Alternafest.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and...
right! Wasn't he affiliated with Gathering Ground somehow?
He was affiliated with that guy. His name was Doug Kirshner. He was affiliated with pretty much everything going on in the scene back then.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on his label, and then somehow we got off of that label and moved over to Takehold.
Gotcha.
How did the Takehold thing happen?
John Pope.
John Pope,
he was like the driving force behind that connection, and then... You know, pretty soon, like, we're all sitting down, I think, in John LaRussa's living room with papers in front of ourselves, like, all right, we all going to sign? And it's like, you know, you got to sign on the dotted line. And we did. And then, you know, you don't really know, like, you have stars in your eyes, you know, because you're so young and it's like your first big thing. But Chad was like, you're going on tour. And it was like, holy crap, like, this is happening.
Yeah.
And we were just relatively young. I mean, teenagers and early 20s.
Did the EP, the first EP, did anything really come of that? Like, was that like it comes out where people like kind of, did you kind of sense like something was happening, like it was gonna?
Yeah, like that was
from that EP,
fire starter right there. I mean, if you listen back to like, well, at least when I listen back, that album had like the most like piss and vinegar out of any. You can definitely feel like the intensity. I hate the production. I mean, it is what it is. We were young, you know. We got what we paid for on that. But you can I feel like you can definitely feel the insanity on that. And I think that energy really kind of sparked everything. It's what got Chad to say, like, okay, I think this could be something. If not now, then at least 2 years from now or something like that.
It's funny listening to the second album when you guys
recorded
New Wave Techno Homicide.
Yeah.
It sounds just like modern music. Like the product, because it was like, you know what I mean? It's that same.
That mid-level, like analog.
Yeah, I was always bummed out about both of those albums production-wise. Like, I wish we could remix both of them and make them sound the heavy. Yeah.
I feel that way about a lot of albums, but definitely I can feel confident in saying it. Because I was on it. I definitely wish it was recorded differently. No offense to Nick or anything. I mean, if you listen to Huntington's records that like Nick is known for, they're awesome. So, I mean,
And they like, sound different. They sound like more appropriate.
Send it to Cliffy.
Right. Yeah, we should.
I never thought about that. Yeah.
That's why I'm here. I'm the good idea guy. Steven's a good looking one. I'm the smart one.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to hear our album with more of like a slicker production. Your album's a little different, but for our new wave album, I want to hear like a little bit more Craven Collapse like production.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally.
Oh man.
Yeah, I think in thinking back, it probably would have been better to I mean, we wouldn't have been, the ice wouldn't have been broken, but I feel like you guys probably should have recorded it like the studio Under Oath was recording it that summer, cuz they had that like thick, heavy, clean.
Yeah, they did.
We had more of like a rock and roll production or something. Like it, but I don't know. I mean, what's cool about the New Wave album is it's like the guitar work on it is kind of, it is kind of like rock and roll, but it's like beefed up to be real heavy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But his riffs are like kind of rocky.
That fits LaRussa, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, LaRussa definitely, and going back to Chad and what he may have seen, if you listen or watch LaRussa in a room play guitar, you can definitely see where that was headed very early on. And I think that John LaRussa specifically was a big part of us moving forward. And then also John Pope, who just had that. He could do the shrill and he could do the low stuff. And then he did sing. It was rocky in the beginning, but he definitely improved with every single album that he was on. So those two guys, I think, really made up like the, like what Narcissus was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when the tour started, we drove out. Our first show was your record release party, I think. It was in Ohio, and it was on the way to Cornerstone.
Yeah, in Akron, I think, at like a barn. It was like a barn type thing.
It was like some big. Yeah. I remember we played there, and the CDs weren't there yet for us, but I can't remember if you guys had yours yet, but we played. It was supposed to be. It was billed as your release show.
That's right.
And we played there with you guys, and...
Gosh, man, I forgot about that.
Yeah, see, I remember...
That's so crazy.
Was it your rental van that Jim broke the window? I'm trying to remember. Something weird happened that night.
I don't remember. That's like the start of the insanity right there.
Yeah, like, I don't understand how it happened, but I remember you guys just rented a van for the tour.
Yeah.
And then he broke a window, like, that night. You don't remember? I remember him doing it.
That's funny, man. But just so many stories like that, like, of insanity on the road. That's just the start. You just reminded me.
Oh, my gosh.
Actually, to go back to that story when we first met in Delaware, the reason that I was so pissed off is because I had, like, stale socks on. Like, like gross. They were, like, cardboard socks. Like, that. I can't remember what we were doing, but I think we were staying at the studio. I think we were sleeping at the studio.
Yeah, you were.
Okay, so...
And to make it worse, Nick Rotundo was leaving to go upstairs and smoke weed.
Yeah, that's right, I remember that.
He kept coming down and he was like all buzzed out trying to record you guys.
Yeah, that's why our album sounds the way it does.
Yeah.
So, I guess I had just, like, planned poorly. Probably not, though. I think we just didn't have a washer and dryer. And so I was so, like, I'm kind of anal, like, I get a little OCD, I wash my hands a lot, stuff like that, so... I had these cardboard socks, and I just could not stand it. It was driving me insane. And then I was young and, temperamental and emotional. And so that was it, man. The first time you ever met me, cardboard socks and throwing down the F-bomb.
Yeah, you were, like, so pissed off. You had that lip ring.
Like, to be honest, oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, lip ring, I aged years, like, I had black hair, like, long, dyed black hair.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, man. So, like, it's funny. I think I can say, like, honestly now, back then, like, we saw a little bit of the fame with recording the album and getting it paid for and going on a tour, and there was just a little bit of arrogance there starting to drum up and come through, and that's when you start complaining about socks, like, that early on.
Yeah. God forbid if you just went to the local Walmart and bought a pack. But
I know.
Spent $5.
But yeah, man, that would speak. That's kind of a good expression for, like, cardboard socks are a great expression for, like, the volatility of the band as well, and what it would become, and the relationships, and how hard tour was from day to day, and just being angry, and inevitably what led to, like, the downfall, and then Derek leaving, and then myself leaving shortly after.
Yeah. But hold on, because before you left, we had a big tour we did together.
Yeah, that's right.
And a lot of life-changing things happened on that tour.
Yeah.
And to this day, one of the funniest, well, I don't know if you'll let me tell the story, or you'll tell the story.
We can go there. I think I know what you're going to say, I've already thought about it.
This guy, you kept us laughing so much on that tour. One of the best stories, I'll start telling it, you can jump in, you tell it, but if you don't want to talk about it, we don't have to, but I'll
tell
you something.
We'll talk about it, it's fine.
It was one of the funniest moments of my entire life. Was,
oh my God, get on with it, I have to work
tomorrow.
You're
talking about Slacker 77 or whatever?
Yes, yes.
Oh, jeez.
So, we go down to Slacker 77, it was known for being a distro of Christian music, punk, and hardcore, and it was also a record store that would put on shows. It was very well known in that scene at the time, and we were booked there. We were all excited about it, and we got there, and it's a beach house right off of Myrtle Beach.
Mm. Yeah, it's like super beach bummy, which I was like really surprised about.
We were all excited. We were like, we're going down to the Myrtle Beach in the middle of this tour. We're going to stay at Myrtle Beach for a day or two.
Yeah.
So we go down to the Slacker. We get down there at like 9 in the morning or something weird, all like messed up from driving all night. And we get in this beach house, and we're all staying in these different apartment rooms up the upstairs level.
Yeah, if you can call them that. They're like little crack houses.
Oh, they were gross. They had like it was like mattresses on the...
Remember the mattresses with like stains and stuff? We'd like throw them at each other and be like, you're going to sleep on this tonight. It was horrible.
But... The long story short is
bed bugs.
Oh yeah, totally. Something crawling around in there. Travis should have come with us.
I don't want to talk about bed bugs.
Yeah, he probably sees them enough this week.
Eight units today.
Oh my gosh.
Gross. Ugh. Yeah. Well, anyway.
Dude, my tents were sweating by the third unit. It was disgusting in there.
The whole breakout came from Slacker 77.
Yeah, right.
Where it originated.
Quick sidebar. Travis, how do you not take them home with you?
I politely asked them not to come in and ruin my life, and they listened to me.
Oh, well, that's a good way to do it.
I understand the biology of the insect. I won't bring them home. I know what I'm doing.
Man, I would be so nervous being around them. But that's because I'm ignorant to it. I don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
But so anyway, we were at this place, and most of Under Oath and most of Narcissus, and I think Jim, all of us were there.
Yeah, we were all there.
Most of Under Oath and Narcissus went to a music store to get materials. They got to get supplies for the tour, strings and sticks and all that stuff. So they all left. So okay. it was the Tantrum guys, all three of us, and maybe. I can't remember if Dan was with. But anyway, it was Chris from, or is his name Chris? He played bass in Under Oath?
Yeah, he's like a tall, ball head.
Yeah, big guy.
Yeah, Chris.
It was him, and it was you and us. And we all went swimming in the ocean. And
that's right.
We came back.
And of course, I wanted to take a shower because I got the hygiene thing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And they're still cardboard socks.
Yeah, I guess that's going to become a running theme. I didn't realize.
How do you not have them on tour? So we're in one room, and across the hall, like door to door across the hall, was where Justin was sleeping. He comes out, buck naked.
Well, I had just taken a shower. I just got out of the shower.
Yeah. And he he comes out the door. Okay, now. The way we're looking at him, okay, he comes out, and we're looking at him, but he doesn't see the hallway behind him. So he comes out completely buck naked, and he's got his wang in one hand and his testicles in the other. That's the only way I can describe it, because that's part of what made it so funny, was he had them separated, kind of.
I don't remember that detail. I just remember I was like covering up a little bit, like
yeah. You were covering yourself. You were covering yourself by holding them, separating them.
Yeah.
And then, it was so funny looking, and you come out walking out, and you're like, "Hey guys, you guys got any shampoo?" And you're only doing it to make us, you know, all see you naked and laugh.
Yeah, I'm just joking around.
And we started dying because what Justin didn't realize was the beach house owner's girlfriend had an apartment up there, and she came up the steps to go into her apartment at the exact same time he came out. And yeah,
so he was like,
he's standing
there. My perspective on it. So, like, I come out of the bathroom straight, and I'm looking at Steven and all those guys straight on. But off to my left, this girl had, like, come up the stairs and stopped. And so I'm like, "Hey guys," and then like I look to my left and I'm like, "Oh my gosh."
And then he turns around and he jumps into his room and that door slams behind him and I just hear him laughing in there. Like slapping. And the girl was like trying to get her keys in the door.
Like frantically.
Like she thought she was gonna get assaulted or something. It was like the most insane.
It was totally insane. We were all laughing. And
we were crying because you thought you were so funny, but then you got busted.
I know, and then I got busted. And then later that night,
man.
Like I met the owner guy.
The boyfriend.
Like, yeah, the boyfriend. He like introduced himself, and I'm like, "Oh, hey, yeah, I think your girlfriend saw me naked earlier."
Yeah.
Like,
wow. You were a much different guy back then, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I just got caught. I mean, I didn't mean to do it. I just got caught, but it was still, like, the funny, like, silly, trying to make everybody laugh type thing.
Right.
I don't know, man. I feel like you would probably still do something like that today.
I don't know about that, but, yeah, I mean, I definitely am still a little bit crazy.
Definitely. For sure.
Yeah, I kept getting stuck in, like, this crazy. And you know what's funny about that is, like, at another house that we went to, I'm just going to make it worse now. Went to another house, and I pretty much did the same thing except for I wasn't joking around. I was just trying to get to my room. And, like, here's the... It was another guy and his girlfriend in the living room, and I was like,
I totally forgot that happened twice.
Why are you walking around naked so much?
I don't know, man. I should have learned to take my clothes to the bathroom. Oh, my word.
Man, that tour was just so nuts. Everybody was getting sick at some different time. I remember John Pope, he'd get, like, real sick, and him and I would go, because we were, like, the vocalists, so we were always dealing with throat issues, and I remember, in fact, in Myrtle Beach, we got a hotel because that place was so disgusting. We were like, screw this. I don't want an STD in this place. So we got a hotel together. But, that was such a fun tour. I mean,
yeah, those were crazy days.
The friendships was fun. But
those are definitely, like, when I look back, it was definitely some of the best times I've ever had in my life.
Absolutely.
And, like, formative years. Like, thinking back, and if I didn't have that, for as much, like, pain as it ended up being throughout, and then in the end, like, the letdown of having quit the band and all that, I'm still, like, super thankful for that whole time, and I just feel like every young person should have that thing that they do, whether it's, like, a road trip, or if it's a tour, or, you hear something.
Missions trip.
Missions trip, yeah, like some crazy missions trip to Guatemala, or you should definitely have like one thing that you do that kind of like is like a, it's almost rebellious in a way. You know what I'm saying? Like you get to the end of your teenage years and you're like, I just want to do something.
It's formative. It's formative. It's what you go back to in your late 30s and reference. Like this is where I was at when I was 20, but or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It makes you who you are now. It really does, because if you've got no cool stories, who the hell wants to talk to you now, you know?
This is true. And you know, we're all of us are setting ourselves up by saying this, because we all have kids, and at some point, they're going to get to that age, and they're going to be like, yeah, I want to go and do this, and it's going to be some totally insane thing, and we're going to lose our minds.
Yeah. Shut up, Justin.
I know.
If my kid says, hey, I want to start a band and go on tour, I'm going to be like,
I'll go with you.
Kyle, please, no.
I know.
No, Steven will say, don't get Travis's kid in the band. He'll just quit on you.
Yeah. All of my closest friends, all of their kids are going to bail on you.
Justin, tell us about the day that you had to quit. What happened?
Yeah, man, that was a crazy day. Well, not really crazy. It's just looking back, it was crazy. But what happened is Derek quit.
Derek was the drummer for those.
Yeah, talk about, yeah, I mean, refer
to Derek's the drummer. He's the guy that you're hearing on every Narcissist album until
Crave.
Until Crave, yeah. He was on New Wave Techno, was his last album with us. And he, I can't really remember his reasoning, but I remember he had talked to his pastor, and he'd really kind of gotten counsel over the whole thing.
He
so it wasn't
like,
just
was
like a
like, my bass player refuses to put clothes on.
Yeah. So he ended up quitting, and it was like a life move for him. It was thought out. It was counseled. It wasn't just like I'm fed up with the band, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was just ready to move on in his life. He had his whole life ahead of him. He was looking forward to things, and he said, this has taken up enough, and I want to move on. So he talked to me about that, and that kind of encouraged me. I was kind of feeling the burn between the same types of things, wanting to know what the future was like, and then also, like, just the really hard, like, the way that great relationships had turned sour at that point, and a lot of it because of the tour. I mean, you stick, four guys, five guys on tour, and in a close proximity, money's super tight, you're fighting over a Subway sandwich at some you come off of that for 40 days, and it really does affect your relationships, and then also sleeping on floors and stuff like that. Like, even today, I have a hard time sleeping with a pillow, because for 40 days, I slept on flat surfaces.
Wow.
Like, it's just kind of a weird, small thing of, like, how that tour shaped my life. That's one of the weird ways. That and hearing loss. But anyway.
Definitely.
Yeah, well, dude, me putting earplugs in at the choir show was hilarious.
Oh, I know. I'm like, dude, how old are you? Come on.
I know, it was insane.
Anyway, I put earplugs in everywhere I go. Steven makes fun of me, too.
So anyway, getting back to...
And I'm the one that's like, what?
Yeah, exactly. I just can't hear anything at practice. Yeah, put earplugs in, doofus.
So he quit, and then like I was struggling with the same things, and then the bad relationships, and then I called John and said, "Hey man, I think I'm done. I think this is it for me." And John LaRussa is who I'm talking about. And then he basically said, like, "Are you sure you're done?" Like, because John LaRussa clearly was not done. If you know anything about the path that he took after Narcissus, he continued Narcissus on, and then when that stopped, he turned it into Inhale, Exhale, mm-hmm. and then and onward from that.
Yep.
So he was not ready at all, and he kind of gave me the third degree, you know, like, "Are you really sure you want to do that, man? Because, like, I think there's something here, and we could do this and this." And I was like, "Yeah, I think I'm done." And that's how it ended for me. And then, you know, I can go further from there, just that I haven't really picked up an instrument since. Mm. And my whole life has kind of turned into, like, running my business and being married.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, we skipped a huge
year. Yeah, thing. Wait a minute.
Hold it's fine. It's hard.
Before your pants burst into flames there.
I know. There's like 15 years, right? There's like so much that we could say.
It was interesting because my sister Desiree, she would come to concerts with us, and she would sometimes travel with us a little bit, like to like Maryland or Delaware or something, like just, you know, overnight type shows. She went through a phase where she was hanging out, you know, a lot with the band and just having fun. And she would go to these shows, and she'd meet other band members, and there would be guys that would say, "Oh man, she's really good looking. Who is that girl?" "That's my sister." You know, Desiree, what's so funny is Desiree never, like, fell into that, like, dating the band guys thing. Like, she was always, like, smart. Hanging out. Yeah, right. Well, up until, right?
Smart. Yeah.
But it was so weird. Like, I had so many guy friends in bands that you would have seen on a regular basis,
mm-hmm.
and Desiree was never interested. And it was so funny. You never, if someone would have told me we'd go on this tour with a bunch of take-hold bands and we would play a show at one of our house show, because it was like a local show to us, and my sister would come and fall in love with some guy in a band on my tour, I would have never believed you. But it was so strange how that all happened. And, you know, the quick version is, we played a show in Delaware. Desiree came out because we, you know, she always did, and that was where we always played. And this time we had the tour with all the bands, and we all played. And you guys met, and I remember thinking, like, yeah, Justin's just like another one of those guys who wishes they could get with my sister.
Right.
But this time it worked. Yeah. And I remember being like, "What? The guy from Ohio?"
it was really weird.
I just remember you were playing on stage, and Desiree was on the phone or something with me.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how this happened, but somehow
she was in Ventura or something like that.
Yeah, you like leaned over and, like, said hello to her on the phone as you were literally riffing.
Yeah.
Something weird like that, and we all were thinking it was really funny. I also remember a funny story of you mooning me, and she caught it.
Oh my gosh, that happened in Delaware. Yeah, yeah. You guys were all in the van, and I thought it was... You guys were all in the van. I'm sorry. That's so funny, dude. Like, actually, there's, like, three stories of me and nudity.
And you getting caught by women.
I know, I'm getting caught. That is so weird.
Why are you not in jail?
I'm actually calling in from jail. I got like 1 minute left.
I'm actually starting to feel a little awkward now that I'm starting to feel like my cousin married a pervert.
Yeah. So I thought it was just him in the van. I thought it was just him. So like I mooned him, and here it was like a van full of people.
Nice.
Yeah. And that's how it always works. Anytime he thought he was going to be, "I'm going to be the funny naked guy," like, it always backfired.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I think what Steven is like politely trying to say is that Desiree was like way out of my league. So, like, I was young.
Oh, man.
I was young, and I would say and do whatever I wanted to do around that time. I mean, you heard it with the cardboard sock arrogance is basically what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had nothing to lose, I guess, and that's how it felt. And I didn't think anything would come of it. You're on tour, you're young, who cares?
Yeah.
Which is a horrible line of thinking, by the way, but that's how it was.
Yeah, totally.
And, after tour, we kind of struck up a phone relationship, And then Steven and I, you and I stayed friends. And then I would come out here to quote-unquote see Steven, but I was actually coming to yeah. quote-unquote see
Steven. I think I saw you for like 5 minutes during this trip. I remember we went to a restaurant here in town on one of your visits, and I remember you telling me you were working on the music that would becoming Leviathan.
Yeah, that's right.
You were telling me about some of the riffs that were on it and stuff that you guys wrote. And I literally remember you telling me about da na 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 da da na da na na da da da, which I don't know why, like, you just literally hummed it to me in the restaurant. I remember being like, that's a cool riff. And then when I heard it later, you weren't on the record, but I heard it on the record. I remember thinking, like, that's the riff he was telling me about.
Yeah, that's the riff.
Well, yeah, I remember you sat me down in this restaurant, and you were telling me you were going to quit the band, and you and Dee were going to get serious and stuff. And I remember just being like, what the heck? Like, this is crazy. Nuts. Yeah.
Yeah, man, that song, I helped John write that song, John LaRusso write that song, and it was kind of the first song. We didn't know it. No one knew it was going to be Becoming Leviathan, we knew it was going to be the next record, but that was the first song after New Wave, so that's like real, that's a baby, you know, like we were really excited about that. And that song was like such a new sound, it was like dancey a little bit, and the whole album didn't turn out that way. The album turned out really good, actually. Becoming Leviathan I really enjoyed, even though I had nothing to do with it except for that song. It was like Tool-ish and just real airy, and John Pope's vocals got real deep on it, and I really liked that effort.
That album meant a lot to many people. That was one of those albums that I remember watching people just on their hands and knees, just extolling and crying and singing along. And I remember being at shows, being like, "Say what you want about Narcissus, man. There's something brewing
underneath there."
Definitely.
It's so crazy, having been in the band, I wish that I would have been more engaged as a fan after I left, because I feel like I missed so much. It's funny, when they went on to do, like, when I listen to those albums after I was gone, Becoming Leviathan and Craven Collapse, I feel like I'm still there in some small part, even though I'm not. I'm not even a thought. I have nothing to do with the writing or anything, but your heart is there in such a weird way.
Sure.
I just wish I was a fan. I wish I would have seen them live, and I missed it all. So
yeah,
I regret that.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of hard. They got signed to a major, I think, Century Media or something. And,
yeah, they did. Yep.
And it was like, but it seemed like as big as their business dealings were, the smaller the band ended up being. Like, it's like they weren't working nearly as much as they were during the Takeover era.
Yeah, I would talk to John. on the phone periodically during the Century Media days, and it was always, it felt very much like a turbulent road. It was much bigger than it had ever been in the past, and there was much more responsibility and a lot more like money conversations, and I just remember that being a little bit of a trying time, I think, for them.
Yeah.
Those conversations are never fun. Bands always, like, what do you mean we have to have a meeting about, you know, stickers? we're not selling enough of this t-shirt, and it gets not fun really fast on a rocket. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The whole industry like kind of shifted as they did that, and it seemed like what it ended up being was the way that you make money at shows was through merch and through touring. And it just becomes very hard to sustain if you have a family and you have other aspirations.
Matter of fact, wasn't it LaRussa that, I mean, I quote him a lot. I think he's the one who said, I used to be in a band that sells merch, and now I'm in a roving merchandise company that plays music.
I think he said something at some point in like that paraphrase. I'm not sure.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm sure I botched that up, but it kind of made me feel like, man, I always just wanted to play drums and rock out. I don't want to sell shirts. You know, like
It becomes a lot of branding and even like, you know, you look at like the big bands, like major labels, you know, it's like when you see them, it's like you see Verizon banners everywhere. And it's like, all those big tours are sponsored now.
And yeah, exactly.
Like, it's not, you can't just call them up and go, hey, you know, we're going to play this venue and we're going to sell tickets and the band's going
to. Yeah, exactly.
It's none of that anymore.
This music that inspires you to be something that you aspire to be is brought to you by Gillette Razors and
exactly, yeah.
What?
Yeah, exactly.
The whole thing just goes, you know.
It's true.
So can we? I don't know if like we'll cut this out if it's not cool. I'm curious because it to me when Derek had his accident, and I don't know if you talked to him and he's we're weird about talking about that stuff, but
I don't think so. I think he's since made peace with all of that. And
yeah, I've seen him on Facebook a lot more, and he's been posting more pictures and stuff. And like,
yeah,
kind of nice to see him kind of just sort of relax and let himself, you know, show himself to the world. But Derek, it felt like a different band when you and him quit. And I remember, what year was it? 2000? I want to say 2001, 2002. What year was it when he had that accident?
I think it was 2001. I think it was the next year.
Yeah, I remember we were going to Cornerstone. I think we were going to go to Cornerstone 2002, if I can remember correctly. But I'm not sure about that. But anyway.
So, yeah, I was just going to say.
Yeah, go ahead.
For those of you that don't know, Derek was the original drummer of Narcissus. And after he quit the band, he went on to try to find a job. He was in a masonry apprenticeship. He was in training to be a mason, and he was at work one day and working up on a tall building with a circular saw, and he had leaned back into a power line that was not supposed to be active, but it was active, and he was badly electrocuted, badly burned. He lost both his legs and both his arms, and it pretty much changed his life forever. So, like, the Derek we know now,
that'll do it.
He is still the same Derek, but I mean, physically, he's changed, and he, you know, he still lives in Ohio, and he has a beautiful home, and I think what he's gone on to do since then is he has a recording studio, like this insanely awesome recording studio in his house. In fact, it was featured in, like, Recording Studio magazine or whatever.
What?
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. And he has like super professional like bands come in there and do recording. In fact, he was working with the producer that did like Hoobastank and all these other like really huge bands.
Can I ask an ignorant question?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
How?
How does he have like a huge
someone who lost both of his legs and both of his arms? How is he capable to do that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing actually. Now that I think about it, I mean, it's been so long since it happened, but really someone should do a documentary or something on that guy's life, because if there's ever, like, a story for, like, perseverance or overcoming, he's definitely up there with the top. I mean, the guy's a paraplegic and can hardly talk, and he's been so physically altered. But he continues to follow his passion and do what he loves, and it's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Definitely an inspiration for everybody. But
like, we didn't think he was going to live. Like, we thought he was going
to we thought he was dead, man. I thought he was dead big time. I remember seeing John LaRussa, like, when we got the call that something happened, I was at work, and I was like, I think I should leave. Like, it was that big of a deal.
Yeah.
I could hear it in people's voices, like, I think that I should go. So I left, and I went to the hospital, and no one could get in to see Derek. And
yeah,
then
it was...
around the corner comes John LaRussa and his wife, Rachel, and they had gotten in to see Derek through some, like, lapse in security or something. Like, someone let them in there to see Derek when they shouldn't have.
Huh, okay.
And he had, they made John suit up and everything, but he saw John, and I remember just seeing John's face and being like, okay, I don't think Derek's going to make it.
Yeah.
From everything that he was saying, and it was a pure miracle that he lived at all. I mean, yeah. From what John told me about what he saw, and I won't repeat it just because it's just graphic and horrible, but we thought it was over. We thought that was it.
Yeah.
Wow.
We were all so upset because at the time, you know, we had just, I don't know, we were going off the fumes of this great time we had together, this whole summer we spent together and all, and Derek was just one of those guys that kind of stuck with us a lot more. It was, you know, everybody had their cliques on those on tours like that. And
yeah.
Under Oath kind of, you know, we had a couple friends in Under Oath, but really they kind of thought they were like the headliners all the time. And like Narcissists and Few Left Standing and Tantrum were kind of like the three bands that sort of stuck together. There was these little cliques. And Derek was one of those guys. And so, like, we just loved that guy. And when we heard about that, we were just, like, so sad and devastated. Especially because, you know, he being a drummer and not being able to, you know, hold the sticks. And it just, and all that, just such a bummer. And
yeah, but shortly after, I think it may be a year after that happened, but the drummer for Def Leppard was in Cleveland doing a show, and he, like, swung by the hospital and saw Derek. And
yeah.
Got to talk with him and stuff and kind of say, like, hey, man, you know, like, keep your chin up. You know, what you're going through sucks, but look at me, I'm without an arm, and kind of got to share a story with Derek, and I think that was a big deal for him at that time. I mean, it would have been for me.
Yeah, that was amazing.
But yeah, like, people came out of the woodwork to kind of, like, help him through that time, and it was just amazing. Like, there definitely should be some type of, like, documentary or documented story about that guy's life and experience.
Totally.
It's really awesome. But a funny story about Derek, when we first were going out on tour, we all met at John LaRussa's house, and we, like, you know, we had our book bags and our like, pillows and all that stuff, and we have, like, you know, like, essential, like, road gear or whatever, and Derek walks around the van, and he's got tucked underneath one of his arms is, like, this giant jar of creatine. You know those, like, weightlifting? Like, those giant jars of, like, powder?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
He's got that under one arm. He's, like, barely holding on to, like, a pillow. And in the other arm, he's got, like, a few six-packs of Slim Fast. And I'm like, Derek, what are you doing? And he's like, gotta stay in shape, man. Gotta keep
Yeah, he was, like, so...
On the road.
Yeah. I remember, like, stopping in places and he would buy stuff like that, and I'd be like, just, like, dude, he's so freaking, like a health nut. So
it's always, like, the drummer who's the weird one. Always.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Without question.
But, yeah, man, that was funny. And then Derek, I mean, I don't know, there's so many stories on tour. There's actually some footage out there on YouTube, I think, of Derek, like, shooting bottle rockets and stuff on tour.
Oh, yeah.
And there's, actually, he put together, like, this montage. It's really cool. I think it's on YouTube or Facebook somewhere.
Yeah, I'll send it to Travel. We'll link it. It's funny.
Yeah, you rejoined Narcissus.
I did.
And then it fell apart. So explain that.
Yeah, so I'll jump through, like, I'll jump over a lot. So Desiree and I had gotten married at that point. We had moved from Ohio to Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And I was running my own business, just starting to run my own business, like circa 2007, 2008, somewhere in there. And John and I got on the phone. We talked periodically. All the guys in the band kept contact periodically after that. We weren't mortal enemies or anything like that, because I figure, like, from what I said before, people might take that from it. But we weren't. We left on amicable terms.
Mm-hmm.
So John and I are talking, and him and John Pope were talking, and somehow it turns out they had just put out Craven Collapse, but the lineup that they had at that point was kind of disintegrating somehow. I forget exactly how.
Yeah.
And they said, I think Steven Cushman was going to move on. He played drums for Narcissus after the original lineup disbanded.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to move on, and Josh King, who was playing bass, was going to move to drums. And then I was going to come in.
Which makes sense, because he was the drummer for Vessel.
That's right. He was originally a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to come in and pick up where he left off on bass. So I had learned the entire Craven Collapse album, which to this day is my favorite Narcissus album.
Mm-hmm.
And I was super excited. I talked to Desiree about it. I was like, look, I think I'm going to start like this little clothing merchandise merch like brand to tour with, and that's how I was going to make money. So there's a lot more like planning and thought that went into it, because life had moved on. I'm married. I have bills to pay. When I leave, like, the bills don't pay themselves. So I had to contribute. So we had all this lined up, and then it just fell apart.
How? What happened?
Because we decided either we're all in or we're all out. And then Josh said, he was having a baby at that time, and he said, look, which was something that none of us had a baby at that time, a kiddo. So he was the first one, and then he said, look, it's time for me to move on. I got to grow up. I got a kid on the way. And since we made this pact with each other that we were either going to be all in or all out, then everyone was all out, and that was it.
Huh. Josh King ruined Narcissus. Got it. You heard it here.
That's all he hears.
Yeah.
I just want the exclusive. I want listenership, man. It's all about growing listenership.
Yeah.
I don't care if the content's any good.
Running around in circles with myself, I'm running around in circles to keep up, running around in circles to fill this, running around in circles to live my
So you quit the band and married my sister, you became my brother, and is that the end of the story or what?
I don't think so. I don't know how much of this you want to talk about and everything, but I think one of the most inspirational stories that I've ever heard is couples getting pregnant and
yes.
Not being able to and going through what you guys went through for 8 years. And talk about that as much as you feel comfortable talking about it, because I talking about band stuff is fun. I played bass, we rocked out, okay, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
If there's somebody out there trying to get their wife pregnant and things aren't working out, I think you have an inspirational thing to say.
Yeah, man. So basically, we got married, and you know, as any married couple, you don't really think about kids or your ability to have them or anything like that. It's just, you know, business as usual. You're just living life and you don't really think about it. So you know, a little bit into the marriage, we're living in Whitehall, up by UTRAV.
Mm-hmm.
We first moved to Pennsylvania. We lived up in the Lehigh Valley. We had an apartment there. And that was kind of the first time that Desiree ever said, like, hey, I think we're having trouble with this. We should go and talk to someone. And even then, I just didn't take it seriously. We didn't know a lot about fertility treatments, and we were kind of like natural type people. We're not hippies by any means, but we wanted to go the natural route. And that kind of started the whole journey. It turns out, like 8 years later, we're like, oh my gosh, we can't have kids. It's been 8 years. So we had 8 long years of infertility, and then, man, to tell you every in and out of that journey would literally take a few hours.
Right.
We've been to so many clinics and had tried so many things, but we kept stiff-arming IVF, which is in vitro fertilization. It's where they basically play God and go in there and do everything. Like, everything is assisted. As far as, like, the sperm getting into an egg, and as far as, like, cultivating the eggs and freezing them and then physically fertilizing and dropping that back into the womb, and it's just really complicated and complex. And even within that, there's, like, more procedures that are complex. But
mm-hmm.
We stiff-armed the IVF thing until 8 years later, and then... or 7 years later, and then we finally did IVF and had our baby girl, which is a complete miracle. Oh, man. Totally blew our minds.
Mm-hmm.
I remember getting the call, and
we were like rejoicing and crying and doing cartwheels. Yeah. We were so happy.
It was like such a celebration because, you know, we it wasn't just as simple as like, well, they can either be parents or they won't be parents. It was also just like how it was affecting Desiree, how it was affecting Justin.
Yeah.
It was like the relief of not only did it work out and we're going to have this baby come into our family, but it was also like seeing this a huge answer to prayer and how it like helped shape them, like, you know, my sister and Justin and all. I just remember
One of the weird reasons I brought this up, a little bit of a selfish motivation, isn't it interesting that on one side of a Bible verse, there's people crying and rejoicing and saying this is a miracle, and there's other people out there saying that you broke the rules.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
I think I understand where those people think that they're coming from, but this is one of those walk a mile in their moccasin situations where I feel like, you know what, instead of telling me how right and wrong it is, why don't you talk to my cousin D?
Right.
Why don't you talk to her husband and then tell me how you feel. And if you still honestly can say, oh, what you're doing is wrong, okay, man, that's, I got nothing else to say after that, because this is one of those stories where I felt like anybody that has anything to say after that is just an ogre.
Yeah.
In my opinion, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the reasons that we stiff-armed IVF is because we were concerned about the ethical, the ethics of it. And then when I sat down with our pastor, Dr. Rogers, here at Westminster mm-hmm. Pres in Lancaster, and he used
during UFC fight, did you guys do a kegger? And you guys
are... No, it was like
picturing that. That's really funny.
I kick ass for the Lord.
1, 2, 3.
Yeah, Dr. Rogers, picturing him like getting into UFC is like, very hilarious.
Okay. Yeah, I could just hear him like, there's another one.
Crushing the can on his forehead. Where were we, Ezekiel? What? Sorry.
That guy is so not like that. Anyway,
why I'm laughing.
Yeah. So anyway, go ahead. He used to be an ethics professor at a college, and he kind of talked to us a little bit about, we had kind of lightly mentioned the infertility thing, and then out of nowhere he comes out with this, you know, if you have any concerns about the ethics of IVF, I wouldn't, and here's why. And he kind of broke it down for us and helped us kind of realize that may be something that we want to pursue.
Can you tell us what he said in like the quick nutshell version?
The quick nutshell version would be that there's just no evidence for like us dying on a hill over this or thinking that it's sinful in any way.
Mm-hmm.
There's no biblical evidence for that. And I do understand that Catholicism and stuff would tell you other things, and there's probably other strict religions out there that would too, but our stance is that there's just no scriptural foundation for making those types of claims. Mm-hmm. And that we also talked about how we in the PCA view miracles, and that's, and part of that is absolutely like advances in medicines, and we see that as miracles.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, absolutely, man.
Yeah, I mean, really. Somebody's wrong for you in vitro, but I bet those same people gave their kid a polio shot, so shut up. You
know? Yeah, I believe that we have a better understanding of science and medicine and all that stuff, but, you know, it's still a miracle. And
yeah, it is.
And it changed our family for the better. It started on a new journey, which, you know, we would soon follow behind with our daughter. It's just such a new thing for our family. It's changed our whole family for the better. And
dude, all three of us have daughters. This is freaking me out. It's just hitting me now.
I feel like we're gonna have a bunch of weddings coming up that we're all gonna be sitting around grumbling at.
Oh. Yeah, exactly.
We're gonna be like consoling each other as...
How the hell are we going to pay for this? Marriage. Hey, listen, starting this week, we're opening up a Patreon account. Oh my God. Yeah.
We're going to fund our daughter's weddings.
Yeah
right. Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely a highlight for our family.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, ever since then, like, something happened in Desiree's body. It kind of reset the biology.
Just about to go. Next thing you know, Justin's like, guess what?
Yeah, we're pregnant again. So, like, right now, literally, we have another baby girl on the way. And it happened completely out of nowhere. You have to understand, with IVF, from the moment that you even think about having a round of IVF, you're under a microscope. Both of us are. Every single move you make is tracked. If you, I'm not sure that people will know anything about IVF, but there's a lot of needles involved. Every night I had to inject Desiree with like these drugs. And
yeah, it was horrible.
No, I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, her whole back was like bruised and battered, and we have these photos of her back just like trashed and all beat up from needles and her legs and thighs. It's just a bunch of different treatments. So anyway, suffice to say, it's a whole process and you're under a microscope. So this time around, she's like, I don't like the taste of coffee, which is really weird if you know Desiree. She absolutely loves her coffee. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we were like, we better go buy two tests and figure out what's going on here. And sure enough, we were pregnant. And the very next week, we heard the heartbeat. So we were just, our heads were screaming.
That's insane. My wife had to stop drinking coffee too. That's so crazy. That's weird.
Yep. What? That was the indicator for us as well when Sarah was like suddenly not craving anything she loved to eat or drink. And I was like, this is so weird. And I was like, of course, the first thing I thought of was, well, we must be pregnant. And she was like, there's no way. There's no way. And I'm like, well, actually, if you remember, there was a way. We went and got the test and it was the same thing. And it's that coffee, you know.
Something's in the coffee.
That coffee, man. They don't like that coffee. Something's going on.
So that's like a huge part of our lives, the infertility. We blogged our way through the whole process, and I can give you that link if you want to share that in the show.
Definitely.
I think anyone suffering from that would be encouraged by it.
Yeah, definitely.
I didn't know you were shooting D up with drugs every night, and I didn't know any of that stuff.
It's this insane process. Like on the blog that we did, we laid out all the drugs and we took photos so you can like literally see what we did. And I remember the people at the clinic were like, you're going to take this and do this, and I had to stop and be like, wait a second, I have to do this? Like, wait, you want me to use
this? Who's coming over to do this for me?
Exactly. I was like, we don't have to come in for this? And she's like, no, you take all this home and do it yourself. I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't know what I just got into.
Oh, yeah. Man.
Well, I remember that one time we came over to your house and she was showing us the scars. She kind of, you know, she pulled her sweatpants down like an inch just so we could see the red spot, and we were just like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. She was making light of it because at that point it was just so much insanity. the only thing you could do to deal with it was make jokes about it and try to laugh about it. But it, me and Sarah would go home and we would be like, man, I can't believe the crap they have to deal with. That sucks.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you do feel like there's a measure of guilt that you feel when you do finally get pregnant, because there's so many stories of people in the trenches and they tried like 4 or 5 rounds of IVF and they just can't get pregnant. And then you feel like super guilty when you finally do. But that infertility is still part of our lives, I feel like. It's still something that we suffer having been 8 years in. And it's led to like a lot of, I still talk to colleagues. I was very public about this when we were going through it. Both Desiree and I were. And I talk to people still and check in with them. They have infertility and I talk to them and I just kind of like empathize with them and say, like, I know. And I'll even tell them, like, we feel guilty having a kid. And I just want you to know, like, it's not lost on us. And so it's kind of been like a little bit of an outreach type thing. So if there's anybody suffering with it, super more than welcome to contact me and we'll jump on the phone and say, hey.
That's cool. That's really cool. There you go. There's his calling. That's where he belongs in the group, is anybody who might be having questions about that kind of stuff. I don't know, man. This is big league adult grown-up stuff, but that's not everybody has to deal with it, but the people that are dealing with it, it's their life.
Yeah, it really is.
Entire life. And I remember that was like, you and Dee were like, oh, they're the couple working on getting pregnant. That was like your thing for like the better part of a decade.
It was like this bittersweet identity that you ended up wearing. And it was like, you know,
endearing in that.
Yeah, it was it got to the point where people didn't know what to say and like we didn't.
Yeah. And like, there's so many weird emotions that go along with it. Like,
yeah, sure.
We were knowing, like, people were saying things to us that were so blatantly offensive from our perspective that they would have no idea. From their perspective, they're thinking they're saying the best thing they could possibly say to soothe your heart. But it was the most devastating thing to hear. And we would have to know, always keep in mind and remind each other through that whole process, like, they're trying to help us. We need to not be this offended and not say anything to them. And it's not a hill we're going to die on, and we need to let it go. And we got very good at that by the end. But it definitely affects everything. It ruins
I remember saying everything I possibly could to encourage my poor cousin, and I was like, I mean, coincidentally, it took my mom 8 years to get pregnant with me, and there wasn't any in vitro or anything. I remember telling her that story, thinking like, I got it. I got the story that's gonna like pull my cousin through, and I'm gonna help her and everything. I think I friggin' squashed her like a bug, and I felt like, oh man, I should have just kept my mouth shut. I was just trying to help. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we understood.
But, man. No, I know you did, but I mean, it's also like. You know, put you. It. I'm not saying like I'm the one who was put in a weird position, because I don't feel that's fair to you guys. But I mean, Tammy, my God, we started to try to get pregnant, and like a couple tries later, she's pregnant with twins. Boom, we did it twice. Twins. Yeah, and then it was like, we're so freaking fertile. I mean, she might be pregnant now just because we shared a straw. You know what I mean? Like, and I felt like I don't even know how to sit at the same table and have this conversation with these folks.
Yeah.
So man, the whole thing sucked, and whatever, who cares? Now you have a baby and another one coming, and now babies are going to start falling out of D like a factory now.
Yeah, now we're starting to talk like vasectomy or what.
Next thing you know.
It's a strange conversation after 8 years of infertility. It's like, are we really here now?
Your doctors are going to be like, really? What? Yeah. Really?
Roll that?
You want to stop this train? We just got it started.
Tell us about Monastery.
Yeah, so Monastery is basically the new Narcissist for me. Since I quit Narcissist,
you walk around naked in front of people you don't know? And
in front of my clients.
That's weird.
Sell them web design.
Winning carfuls of people.
For business. Yeah, pretty much for business. Now I get paid to do it.
Nice.
I did it for laughs back then. And I can show you how to.
Yeah, so, wait till you see the how-to video. Good grief.
Yeah, so after I quit Narcissist, I got in a little bit of agency work. I'm creative guy. I do like web design, web development, and kind of techie nerd stuff like that. And I kind of always done design since I was very young. I pirated a copy of Photoshop, and I was sold. Like, that was it. I was doing stickers and T-shirts for all my bands that I was in and all my friends' bands. And that's kind of where it all started. And then, so after I quit Narcissist, I did the agency route. I was in a creative agency up in the Lehigh Valley.
Nerd.
Yeah, nerd. And it blew up. I got out and started doing freelance. And I've been doing it ever since, actually. That was in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So I started going freelance, and which is basically owning your own company. You just have like this whole proprietorship and selling these services, selling web design and web development services. For primarily, I guess, if you look at my portfolio, it's primarily the entertainment industry, which is like Blockbuster Films and AAA video games.
You've done some big stuff.
Yeah, I've done some pretty cool big stuff. I did the, I can't even remember everything that I've done, but I helped out on the website for Marvel's The Avengers, and that came out for the first time ever, like the first film. I helped out on Thor, I did a few Marvel things after that. Even just recently, I finished the website for the Tumblr site for Sinister 2, which is a horror movie.
Oh, wow.
Coming out soon, so I just finished that.
Didn't you do, at the time that Modern Warfare 2 was like the biggest video game in the history of people?
Call of Duty.
Didn't, or whatever it was. I'm not a gamer, so I have no idea. I'm sorry I'm speaking out of school here, but weren't you like the guy?
Yeah, well, I was part of the team that was the team. So what we did for the, okay, so the game is called Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2. The company that puts that out or develops it is called Infinity Ward. And then the company that publishes it is called Activision. So we were the team that went in and helped Infinity Ward create an online presence for the game. Basically, they created a social network for the game. And we did like advertising and display advertising and a bunch of web design and development and stuff like that. But yeah, that was a really cool thing. That was like one of the really first big things I ever got to do. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm working on this. It's insane. I was going crazy. And I love it. I can't complain at all.
Yeah, it's cool. You've done some really cool stuff.
Very cool stuff.
I had a chance to see sneak peeks of things that he got to do, or things he got to do that they wouldn't end up using, but
yeah,
was made for like movie websites and stuff like that. And
yeah, there's a lot that gets left on like the cutting room floor. It's really a process when you go into this, and there's a lot of. It's a lot of hands in the pot and a lot of companies involved, and sometimes you have like multiple levels of approvals and things get kicked back, and it's work. I mean, that's like every job, I guess.
Didn't you do some stuff? You did stuff for Tarantino, right?
I did, yeah.
Django, was it Django?
Yep, I helped out on the official site for Django Unchained, and so like when this happens, like in my portfolio, you'll see the site that I did, and that wasn't the exact version that made it for the official release.
Right.
But you can definitely see in what was officially done my ideas that persisted. So there's like typically awesome. A few different designers involved, and sometimes what makes it live is like all me. So like when I did work for the Bourne Legacy, that was all me. Like I art directed and designed the entire online experience for that film.
Cool.
And then other times it's like I have an idea here or there that makes it or half me, half not me. And then sometimes I'm completely behind the scenes, and it's not really design. You don't really get to see anything that I did, but I coded some stuff for that experience.
I remember the first time you ever sat down and explained to your dumb cousin-in-law how any of this stuff works. We were in your apartment in Whitehall, and you were like you were working on Fear.net.
Yeah, Fear.net, yeah.
Which was like the horror site at the time.
Yeah, it was like Comcast 4 channel.
Yeah. And I remember you being like, see this on the website? Okay, now watch. And then you like went in and changed something in the code. It was something you were working on anyway, and you were like, I'm going to pull the trigger on this, and then you'll actually see how it changes. So this is how it looks on the website worldwide, and you changed it right in front of me. And that's the gravity that it took for me to go, oh, that's how these people, like, that's all he did was change, like, all those little letters and parentheses and stuff. He just moved some of that around, and, like, that thing turns blue now, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, what, people make money doing this? I was like, where do websites come from? How are babies born? I was so like, where do these things originate, you know?
It's a lot of crumbling in basements.
Yeah, and you did it right in front of me, and I was like, huh. That's pretty cool. I never saw anybody do that before. I never saw anybody change something on a website, you know?
Yeah.
Pretty neat.
So, like, something you guys probably don't even know is that in the last, since I've been doing it, since 2007, the industry, like, the web design and development industry has changed quite a bit. Like, it's saturated. So you can throw a rock and hit, like, 10 web designers, or there's just no shortage. So I've had to kind of, not only have I been, like, banging my head against the wall, running my own business since 2007, I've now had to like completely change the way I do business and what I do in order to survive. Mm-hmm. So if you go to monastery.io, which is my website, you're going to see a bunch of stuff about mobile games, and that's basically what I'm focusing my shifting my focus to. Mm-hmm. So all my like web design and development expertise and digital marketing expertise, I'm basically just focusing that towards helping mobile game companies.
I see your tweets and I read them. I don't understand what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah, you probably see like a lot of stuff about like.
I know he talks on like some other like design language that I'm always like, I don't get it.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's what I've had to do, because basically the money has dropped significantly since I started.
Sure.
And back when I started, if you built a web design from scratch, it would cost you like $50,000 to scale to $100,000. And nowadays, you can buy that type of website for like $8 a month on Squarespace.
Now it's an app. Right.
Yeah, so everything has shifted drastically, and now to survive, you actually have to fulfill a marketing role, which it ends up in like cents and dollars. Like you have to bring real business value to the table in order to attract customers. You can't just be like, oh, build you a cool website. Yeah, well, everybody's got a cool website. Who cares?
Right.
Like, but can you change my bottom line? Can you add $50,000 more to my ROI this year? Because if you can do that, then I'll give you 25. You know, like that's what it's become now.
Right.
Yeah.
The bloated, everybody's making money days are over.
Yeah, I would roll my eyes when people would say I'm quitting my job. I'm going to school to be a graphic artist or something. I remember even like 10 years ago thinking like, yeah, good luck, dude.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
I know like 12 of them.
Yeah, you know, and none of them are rich. And none of them have jobs.
Yeah, I was gonna say, or none of them are rich.
Right. So, I think we covered everything. Joss, you got anything else? You got anything else you
What are you listening to?
Definitely want to talk about music a little bit.
Yeah, let's talk about music. So,
do it.
This is interesting. Like, you guys all collect like vinyl records and stuff. I don't do any of that. I subscribe to this service called Ardio. It's basically a Spotify competitor.
Right.
And for $5 a month, since I sit at a computer all day, I can just stream whatever I want.
Sure.
And there's some things you can't get, like you can't get Metallica because they're big babies, and you can't get like, and you can't get Tool. I don't know why.
Are they big babies, Justin?
I'm hesitant to say that Tool's big babies just because I love Tool.
Because Maynard will eat your soul.
He's an apologist. He's a Tool apologist.
Yeah, he'll stare in my direction and melt me and turn me into wine.
Exactly.
He'll melt me into wine. That band Maranatha.
Yeah.
You know the album with the, I don't know the album names, I'm sorry, the bones, they're on fire.
Spiritless?
Yes.
Yeah.
Dude, that is so good, man.
Yes, it is.
Yes,
it is. Do you know Colin? Because, I mean, he's
an Ohio guy.
He's an Ohio guy, yeah.
I might know him. I don't know if I know
If you
him.
Listen to the podcast, you'd know exactly who he is.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in visiting those episodes.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of episodes I want to revisit. or does it for the first time. But yeah, that band, that album is really good.
Right on, cool.
They just their new album just came out this week.
Yeah, yeah. I listened to that too. I listened to all their whole discography because I wanted to catch up.
Is Phil on there?
Yeah, it is on there. Oh, I listened to that first, and then I worked my way backwards. But man, that Spiritless album, that really, really stood out to me.
It's it just, is. It is.
Oh really man, good. Thick. It reminds me of like a young Ludacris, which is Norman Jean. But it reminds me of them back in that day when there was just everything was raw and like it's just good. It's good. It's good mm-hmm. stuff.
Yeah, it's extremely heavy and dark and
yeah, it's angry. Awesome. And there's even some like super solid heavy riffs on the album with the Upside Down Cross.
Oh yeah, Incarnate. I think
Incarnate.
It's
called. Incarnate.
Yeah, there's a line on there. He screams this line today. He's like, "There is no God" or something like that. It's like really.
So he opens the album with "There is no God."
Yeah, super really good. Powerful.
Yeah, we opened that the episode with him. We played that.
That's awesome. That song.
Yeah.
So now that I've like laid down my cred, I can.
Right. Well, yeah. You alluded to something more embarrassing.
Yeah. So, Vanessa Carlton put
Wait,
out.
Is it? Oh, I thought it was Paula Abdul. Never mind. Ooh, go ahead.
Vanessa Carlton just released a 4-song EP, but Blue Pool, and I listened to it like 4 times today because it's so good.
I don't know who that is. I can't.
Do you remember that song back in the 90s? It was like. You remember this like piano? She does piano stuff.
Or that.
Yeah, walking my way downtown.
Oh, that one.
Yeah, that's Vanessa Carlton. I'm pretty sure it is anyway. But it's nothing like that. She's like older, more mature. She's definitely doing a different thing now, and it's solid. I couldn't believe it when I heard it. So I've been listening to that. it's just really weird.
So unpredictable.
Yeah, that's I think she was going to do a split with Maranatha. It's a shame they couldn't work that out for you.
Yeah.
I heard about that.
Vanessa Carlton, did you say?
I think so, yeah.
I'm not putting a link for Vanessa Carlton in this. What are you trying to do?
Man, solid. It's good stuff. It's like in the vein of like First Aid Kit, or it's kind of like indie. It's like an indie feel. I was very surprised when I heard it.
All right. Is this pop icon gone, like, now I'm finally going to play what I want?
Kind I think of so. Yeah, I think she was young when that happened. I'm speculating, but it was probably a lot of production involved. And I think she's, like, she was always, like, she did the piano thing. So, like, she was doing music.
I think I can respect that.
Yeah, I definitely like the album or respect the album.
It's kind of like an Amy Mann deal where, like, she had those 80s things going on, and then she got away from labels, and then... Now she's like an indie darling who does like soundtracks and stuff.
Cut her toe off in the Big Lebowski.
Oh yeah, it is her. I totally forgot.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm gonna work. I told you, Steven, I'm gonna work Lebowski or Jawbox into every.
You've
episode.
Been successful at doing.
Yeah, I have to. I can't do both. Well, now I did both.
That was pretty good. Pretty anyway. Good.
Steven, what are you listening to? Oh. Justin, shut up.
Sorry.
No, I want to hear more.
I'm totally kidding. Go ahead.
I want to hear more of what Justin's listening to, you jerk.
No, I listen to so much. You probably are gonna have to cut me off at some point. But.
Well, I guess we all have like all the time in the world during our jobs to listen to things. I'm assuming all three of us can just put earbuds in all day long and.
I try to.
Yeah.
Yep. So I'm also listening to. Like, discovered for the first time, which is, I know this is insane, but Pink Floyd's The Division Bell.
I'm finally taking it seriously
for the first time in my life.
Oh, yeah.
It's okay. Isn't that what's cool about music, though? The Division Bell came out, like, 1,000 years ago, and it's new to you now?
Yeah.
That's beautiful, man. It's That's amazing. Great.
1994. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's such a great record.
Yeah, I think, like, it's basically... albums with like a Fender Strat in it, I guess, is like what I'm taking a liking to lately.
Okay.
It's like the David Gilmour, like the go-to album to hear, just to hear him do like all his magical guitar work. Like, it's so lush. I love it.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah, that album, and then The Choir has an album called Chase the Kangaroo, which I can't stop listening to. It's so good.
That's one of my all-time favorites as well.
Other than that, Faith No More's newest, Failure's newest.
I haven't heard Failure's new one. How is it?
Well, at first listen, I didn't like it.
It's good. It has to grow on me more, but
yeah,
it's not bad for sure. It's not Fantastic Planet.
That's whatever. I'm going to see Hum.
I think you're really gonna like Failure. Yeah, we're all going to see Failure Home in Philly, and I think you're really gonna be surprised by Failure. It's I like it's interesting. I hate to say this about them, in case they were ever listening, but there's parts in songs I feel like are boring, but then the next hook makes sense of it all, and it's just kind of really good at crafting their songs in that way.
Okay.
The more I listen to the album, the more complex it is for me.
Yeah,
I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, it's I can tell it's a good album. I just need to grow on it more because it's hard to connect to a new album from a band that whose last album was like 1996, I want to say.
Yeah.
I mean, I graduated high school then. You know what I mean? It's like almost 20 years ago or something.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, and that album was so good. And so you come into it with all that baggage of like, you know, you guys are so far removed from your magical discography. And so, like there's parts of the new album where I'm like, oh, this is really awesome. And then there's times where I'm just like, I forgot I was listening to it. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
I think I just need to pay more attention to it. But I'll be honest with you. I've seen footage of them on YouTube, and I've never got to see them live. But I've seen them live on YouTube, and they look awesome live, and they sound awesome.
Yeah, tight.
And I've been told they're really like sonically huge live. So
that's
going to be a fun show. Them and Hum. I mean, like both of those bands are known for their live sound. So I'm hoping that they tap into like their '90s glory sonically.
I wrote Hum off. I was convinced Hum would be like, when they finally get together, it'll be like three shows in Champaign, Illinois, you know?
Well, that's really what they were doing.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's why. Yeah, and all of a sudden, it's like, they're coming where? Philly. I live here.
What was more exciting was I saw they were doing a tour on the West Coast with Mineral, and I thought,
right.
Well, Mineral would have been cool to see live, too. But
definitely.
I was thinking, man, why won't Hum just for once do one of these get-together once-in-a-while gigs and come to Pennsylvania? And I was complaining about this on a Facebook thread, and somebody's like, well,
they're stupid.
Someone's... well, it wasn't released yet, but somehow this guy knew they were coming to the Electric Factory, and he was from out of state. So he's like, some Electric Factory place, I think they're playing? And I was like, oh my... God. So I Googled around, could not find information anywhere, went on Failure's website, and they had it posted. And I'm like, because he said it was going to be with Failure. The East Coast tour was with Failure, and I'm like, oh, that's even better.
Yeah.
Because Failure is another one of those bands I really wanted to see live and never did. So I was, to me, it was like the perfect double bill. I was like, this is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so excited. That's coming up. That's like 2 weeks away or something.
Yeah, 14th.
Yeah. See you guys
super
there.
Stoked. Yeah, man. I think my fit, yeah, so let's just, yeah, let's move on. Steven, what are you listening to?
Well, the new Failure. And the new High on Fire, which is really awesome.
I have to hear that. I've heard great things.
Quite good.
Luminiferous? Is that how you say that?
Luminiferous.
Yeah. Freaking. It's just, you know, if you just need your face like rocked off real fast, short and sweet, like 35, 40 minute just onslaught, that's the one you want to hear.
That's the one.
Yeah. The other stuff I'm still listening to Sepultura, as we mentioned last week. I'm going through a heavy Sepultura phase that won't stop, and I can't get enough of their live album, the Under a Pale Gray Sky.
Nice.
And I've been listening a lot to Chaos AD and Arise.
Awesome.
So yeah, I'm just really enjoying the old school Sepultura discography right now.
That's great.
For sure.
My turn?
Yeah. Tell us about this band that you told me about today.
Mutoid band.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Justin, have you heard this yet?
No, what is it called? Mutoid?
Mutoid man. It's the lead singer and guitarist is the dude from Cave-In.
Oh, my gosh, dude.
Listen to this.
Hang on. The drummer from Converge.
What?
And the sound guy from St. Vitus in New York plays bass. It's like Queens of the Stone Age for metal fans.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yes, it is. It is so good. Seth W., God bless his beautiful, huge beard. He bought me Mutoid Man vinyl for my birthday. My birthday's around the corner. And I was like going online. I had a problem with my – I had a gift card from work. I won something. And I couldn't get it to work, and I texted him, and I was like, I just want to buy this Mutoid Man album. And he was like, I'm really glad you didn't do that. Spoiled the surprise, but don't purchase it. I bought it for you already. And I was like, what?
That's awesome.
And he sent me a picture of the download card, and he's like, this is yours, so I don't feel weird giving it to you. Take it. So I don't have the vinyl yet because I haven't seen them, but I downloaded it immediately, and I bet you I downloaded it 2 days ago, and I've listened to the album 30 times.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Yeah.
I can't wait to hear it then.
I just put it on loop. I just don't.
I've heard half of the first song and half of the second song, but what I heard so far was just, like, Queens of the Stone Age, yes, but way more progressive.
Way more, yeah.
It's like dudes who play in, like, a tech metal band doing Queens of the Stone Age.
It was like, it would be like if Queens of the Stone Age was like, remember when we were in Caius?
But with Caius, was Caius that cleaner, a little more fuzzy and sludgy?
All right, whatever. It's awesome. Go listen to Mutoid Man. The new album is called Bleeder, and if you don't like it, you're dumb. Just my review.
Wow.
Nice. I remember when you told me about Black Map.
Hey, Black Map. Aren't they great?
They're all right.
Yeah. Why? You don't like them?
They're all right.
Oh my gosh, dude! I listened to the album the other day, and there's one song on there. I forget the name of it, but I don't
know. I'll probably know it. Which one?
It's near the end. I don't know. They have a YouTube clip live, and they're playing it live in Germany. I forget the name. If you said the name of the song, I think I would know.
I don't know.
You don't have to find it, but anyway, the thing is, like, you listen to the front of the album is like, it's front-loaded. There's, like, some heavy good stuff on there, but...
Definitely.
The back of the album it's just so just as good. Like, I was revisiting it the other day. Really, really good.
Yep.
Yeah, man.
You know, what I did like about what Black Map did, though, sorry to bash anybody who likes Black Map, because I love them. It's the drummer from Far, the guitarist from Dredge. And then the dude, the bass player and vocalist.
Yeah, Dredge.
Dude from Trophy Fire.
Yeah,
Justin introduced me to Dredge in the apartment in Whitehall.
He was right. Yeah.
You know what? I think you'd like this band, and they became one of my favorites. They were great. Yeah. Anyway,
and just when they became one of your favorites, they completely changed your sound.
Totally. Yeah. I was like, I'm so stoked to get the next album, and I bought it, and I was like,
yeah, what happened?
Anyway,
it's true, man. They did change. I don't know what happened, but I'd love to hear the story.
Whatever. Black Map was somebody told me about it, and I downloaded the four-song EP for $4. And then the full-length album came out digital only, and that was, $10. The four-song EP, the songs on that EP were exactly the same on the full-length.
Yeah.
So I bought them twice. Now they came out with it on vinyl.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I want it so bad. I'm not buying your freaking record a third time, though. You know? So, I don't know. Sorry, guys. You did it backwards, in my opinion, you know?
Vinyl is a select thing. You got to get the right ones.
I want it. I want it bad. But I'm not buying those four songs for the third time. I feel like an idiot, you know?
Yeah, I'd be ridiculous.
I think that's, like, my favorite type of band to listen to. It's just, like, Dredge, super solid from start to finish.
Yep.
Far, super solid.
Oh my God, you have to hear Mutoid Man.
Those types of bands. So, like, I'm super excited that you brought up Mutoid because I just definitely want to check that out.
Yeah, and the cool thing about RDO is you can just Mutoid Man later, and it's yours.
Yeah.
Already done. Every Tuesday, I, like, go to new releases. I look through. I got to get through, like, a lot of R&B though. There's, like, a ton. People love that stuff. I don't know what the deal is, but once in a while, you'll see something in there sticking out, and you'll be like, oh.
And other than that, I've been listening to Paul Simon's Graceland album.
Ain't nothing wrong with it. No shame in that game. I love that album.
Never heard it.
Right, completely from the norm of what we're talking about.
It's true.
Steven is the boy in the bubble.
Yeah, good song.
All right.
Cool.
I think we all kept each other on the phone long enough. Anybody else got anything to say?
I don't think so. Hopefully it wasn't like that boring.
No, this was good. This was a good one.
Oh, good.
A lot of fun talking. Got some good serious stuff in there. And
yeah, Steven and I were talking before. We were convinced that you'd be really boring and terrible.
That's awesome. There's like so many. There's so many narcissist stories, man. There's just so many.
Why didn't you tell us any?
I can't remember them all. It's so insane.
Oh. Cool.
Well, Justin, I'll see you tomorrow somewhere, probably.
It's true. Weird. It's so weird. The vibe is weird because it feels like we're just on the phone and like we're going to see each other like this weekend at a family event where we like trade beers and talk about music.
I don't get to see you guys as often because I'm up north or east. I guess I'm up and east. But we just had the family thing, so we could. I just met Steven's daughter for the first time. I saw your daughter Jules for probably the second, maybe third time in my life, yeah. And it was really great seeing everybody. Yeah. We don't do that enough.
Absolutely, we need to do it more often.
Yeah,
for sure.
Now it's gotten like so weirdly personal that all the listeners are probably like, "This is strange. I feel like I'm listening to a family reunion."
Yeah. This is our show.
Yeah, yeah.
But please keep listening.
Yeah.
Justin, thanks so much for joining us, and man, we really appreciate the time. And anybody who never listened to Narcissist before, go check out some of the stuff. It is definitely one of the better bands you never heard of if you're not a Narcissist.
Yeah, man, thanks. Even the stuff that I wasn't on, like I think it's great.
Especially the stuff you weren't on. That's
especially the stuff that I wasn't.
Yeah, it's actually I like it more because I prefer it because you're not on it. No. But anyway, thanks for joining us, man, and bearing your very personal what?
Bearing my heart and my backside.
There you go. There's the title. Always looking for a title. I was gonna go for cardboard socks. I might go with that now. But yeah, thanks for the time, man. Greatly appreciated, and we love you. Thanks so much,
man. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks, man.
There is a girl in New York City who calls herself a human trampoline. Sometimes when I'm falling, flying, tumbling in turmoil, I say, whoa, so this is what she means. She means we're bouncing into Graceland. And I see losing love is like a window in your heart. Well, everybody sees you're blown. Everybody feels the wind blow. Ooh, in Graceland, I'm going to Graceland. For reasons I cannot explain, there's some part of me wants to see Graceland. And I may be obliged to defend every love, every ending, or maybe there's no obligations now. Maybe I'm a reason to believe we all will be received in Graceland.
We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.